one of my purposes of being here is to encourage you to get down to the exhibition on the Dead Sea Scrolls in San Diego, because it is a wonderful opportunity for you to see that body of evidence that no one knew about until 1947 that helped us to be able to push back the text of the Old Testament another almost 1,000 years beyond any of the older copies we had prior to that time. The oldest fragment of the Old Testament that was available was from about A.D. 600, and that was highly debated, and it was very fragmentary. And then to get these scrolls, some of them dating back to 300 years before Christ, really pushed the envelope and helped to better understand what was happening in the matter of those scrolls and in the matter of the development of the Old Testament text. God has, in His sovereignty, in His providence, allowed these types of discoveries so that we might understand all the better exactly how accurate our Bibles really are. There was a lot of debate. In fact, in the 1930s and 1940s, we have a rise of higher criticism unlike any other period of history, and a lot of debate about the accuracy and the dependability, the authenticity, the integrity of the Old Testament text. And with these finds in 1947, all of that radically changed very quickly, almost overnight. You hear all the stories about how it was found, and there's probably several different accounts of that, and I'll give you one of them this morning. But just to start out with the fact of about what type of information do these finds provide us? And first of all, we find out it provides us vital information with regard to the history of Judaism itself. What did the Jews believe during the time just prior to Christ's coming? What did they believe during that time when he was here on earth? How accurate is Paul's description of what Jews believed in the first century? These bits of material we have from Qumran and from other sites around the Dead Sea help us to better understand Judaism from about 300 BC all the way down to AD 135 to the time of the rebellion of Bar Kokhba. It also gives us a better understanding of the accuracy and integrity of the Old Testament text itself, because now we have our oldest possible manuscripts that have been discovered to date. Now, will others be discovered someday? We don't know. What does God have in store for us in the next 60 years? There's no way we can foresee that or even talk about it intelligently. It's merely guessing about what we might find. But I'm convinced that everything that is found will continue to support the accuracy and integrity of our biblical texts. As we think about that, there is one older text that could be argued as being older than the Dead Sea Scrolls, but all that is two verses out of Numbers chapter 6, verses 24, actually three verses, 24, 25, and 26. The high priestly blessing has been found on a silver amulet that was found outside the old city of Jerusalem back in 1976, and it is dated to 600 BC. That's our oldest biblical text, but it's still about 800 years removed from the time of Moses, who originally wrote that. These scrolls discovered, some say in 1946, November or December, some say it was in January, February of 1947. Depends on the different stories of the Bedouin shepherds themselves who were involved in that discovery. The man there on the right is Muhammad Adib, known as the Wolf. His real name is Muhammad El-Hamed. And he's one of the three shepherd boys. They were cousins that were out watching sheep. Some say they were goats, so we don't even know what they were watching. They were in the Wadi Qumran, and for some reason, one of his cousins, started throwing rocks up into a cave mouth there along the wadi, and they heard something crash. And from that time on, the story really varies, because at one point they say they looked in, saw broken jars, were afraid that there were jinn in those jars, the idea of spirits, you know, like the genie. You rub the lamp, you know, and the genie comes out. They were afraid of that, so they ran away, and the next day, Muhammad Adib came back on his own to check it out because he was a little bit braver than the other two. That was one story. The other one is two of them went back up there at that time and checked it out. Another story is they left and came back the next day when it was they had more time, and searched it out. They went inside. They found a number of jars. Most of the jars stood about 2 feet high. There were a number of broken jars. They started searching through the jars, hoping to find gold and treasure. Instead, they found some bundles that were wrapped up, and they unwrapped one of them and found out it was a scroll with some writing on it that they could not understand. And they eventually took those from the cave, took them home, kept them in their tent, and eventually made their way to Bethlehem, where they contacted a dealer who then contacted the patriarch of the Syrian Orthodox Church in Jerusalem, Yeshua Samuel, and they sold the scrolls to him. He bought, I think, 4 scrolls for a total of about 24 pounds British at that time, be equivalent to about $100. And then at a later date, because eventually 7 scrolls came out of that first cave, because the first one found, it's called Cave 1. And the 7 scrolls were separated because Samuel wouldn't sell the others. And eventually he made his way to the United States and put an ad in the Wall Street Journal to sell them. And they were sold, and Eliezer Sukinik of the Hebrew University was a fellow who was agreeing to these things being sold. And amazingly, Sukinik's own son, Yigael Yadin, purchased them from his father in the United States anonymously in order to get them returned to Israel, and paid $250,000 for them. So it's quite an interesting little bit of acrobatics went on in these early times. And this is a time when you have the British mandate in Palestine. You have Israel being formed. Everything is in turmoil within the land. It's dangerous to even travel in the land. So the history is just unbelievable, the way that all these things come together and all these things that have happened in the meantime. And it's taken over 50 years to publish all of the Dead Sea Scrolls. And the final publication came out in 1999, and there are awaiting other publications of minor fragments that have not yet been identified, but the majority of all those that could be published have now been published. This is the 60th year since the finding of those scrolls. So it took a good deal of time. The scrolls themselves are in 3 different languages, Hebrew, Aramaic, and Greek. There are 9 different sites. Among those sites, we have places like Qumran, where the majority of the texts were found, Masada, that fortress of Herod down there next to the Dead Sea. Mentioned in the Old Testament is a place where David fled to for refuge as well. Nahal Hever, a series of caves there where Bar Kokhba and his men head out. And also Wadi Murabaat. So there are a number of places where the scrolls have been found throughout the region. There's a history there because back in the time of Origen, an early church father who lived at the end of the 2nd and the beginning of the 3rd century A.D., he was doing a large work using parallel translations of the Old Testament to try to establish the text of the Old Testament in Hebrew and try to revise the Old Greek translation known as the Septuagint. As he did that, he got hold of a manuscript of the Psalms in Hebrew from a cave near Jericho. And then shortly after that, Eusebius, the church historian, talks about someone else getting another scroll from that same area. Then in the 8th century, a man who was the head of the Syrian Orthodox Church at the time, lived in Seleucia in Iraq, wrote a letter describing how just 10 years prior, a cave had been entered and scrolls had been found. People had gone to Jerusalem, brought back Jewish leaders, and they had taken from that cave anywhere from 70 to 140 different scrolls. So this is not the first discovery. This was just the discovery most recently and in modern times. The Essene community of Qumran is located just south of Jericho, about 7.5 miles. And in its 11 nearby caves, a large number of manuscripts were eventually uncovered in the decade from 1947 to 1957. Further south, at Masada, is where the Jews entered a suicide pact when the Romans surrounded them, eventually taking that area in 73 AD, but not before all the inhabitants were dead. And they had drawn lots to see who would be the last survivors, who would be the ones to kill their families and other people, and then who would be the last one to have the sword. And they know the story because of the fact that there were a couple of women who hid and who were not killed and were able to reveal the whole story to the Romans after they took it over in AD 73. Qumran was destroyed by the Romans in AD 68. Now, as you look at the map, that you can see where some of these locations are and how they fit. You can see there that there are 210 plus now. I believe the actual total to date is closer to 214 different biblical books that have been found at Qumran. Wadi Murabaat, which is halfway between there and Masada, just about where the Bar Kokhba caves are found, is one of the locations where a number of manuscripts have been found. And then again at Nahal Hever, closer to Masada, some more finds have been uncovered, dating from anywhere from the 1st and 2nd century AD. As we look at Qumran itself, the first cave, cave number 1, is just north of the ruins for the community at Qumran. And it was in that cave that the Isaiah scrolls were found, the most famous of those, the great Isaiah scroll. When you go to San Diego, on display will be a facsimile edition of that scroll. You'll get to see it all laid out, the longest of all the scrolls, and you can walk through it and see it from chapter 1 all the way through chapter 6. The Habakkuk commentary, a rule scroll, rules for the community, and a war scroll talking about the war between the sons of darkness and the sons of light, and thanksgiving hymns patterned after the Psalms, but a large collection of poetry and songs used in worship at Qumran. Cave number 3 is the farthest to the north. In it was found the copper treasure scroll that hid told where the people at Qumran had hid their various treasures of coins and gold and silver. A number of men have spent decades trying to find all those treasure sites. To date, not a single treasure site has been uncovered or anything found, although at Qumran itself, over 700 coins have been found. Cave number 4 is the most important site. It's the one you see all the pictures of. It's the one right there where you see the hole in the side of the marl. You can stand at the site where the community of Qumran is, and you can look right across the way to this and see it. It's a little bit difficult to climb up to it. It can be dangerous as well. It actually originally had two different rooms, and within those rooms they found 140 biblical scrolls, the largest contingent of scrolls found anywhere on the site. Cave number 5, which is right next to it, it's just underneath this arrow right here. Cave number 5 is where they found a copy of Amos. They found what is called the Damascus document, which had already been known from Egypt and now was found in its oldest copy there. Cave number 6, where they found a copy of the Song of Songs. Cave number 7, 19 fragments is all they found. Fragments like this one over here on this side. Fragments like that. Not a single Hebrew or Aramaic manuscript in the cave. All of them are Greek, which has made people wonder why. Why Cave 7 only Greek manuscripts? Cave number 11, one of the caves we walked to in 98, had a psalm scroll that is a much celebrated scroll, a very large scroll, and the so-called temple scroll. 900 different texts found in all of these 9 Dead Sea sites, including the 11 caves around Qumran. Among those 900, we find that about 200 of them, about half, are what we call secular scrolls. They're non-sectarian. They're not Essene worship or religious scrolls. They're not biblical scrolls. And then you have the sectarian scrolls, about 25% of those, about 200, are specifically related to the way that the Essenes or whatever group was there at Qumran worshipped and the things they believed. And then 210 plus of these are biblical manuscripts, copies of Isaiah, copies of Exodus, Genesis, Deuteronomy, etc. Thousands upon thousands of fragments. From one cave alone, 40,000 fragments found. Fragments that, as you can see here, some of them very, very small and in very bad condition. Think of having to put all that together to try to do this gigantic crossword puzzle that is actually thousands of different puzzles to have to put these tens of thousands of fragments together. And this is part of the reason why it's taken so long to get things published, and why even today there are yet new finds that will be made. New techniques, infrared photography, types of imaging techniques used to look at with x-rays and everything else to look at the fragments to try to discern writing on them where the deterioration of the material is so bad that looking at it with our eyes, we don't see anything. But you get that type of imaging done and you can see the writing on it. Things like that are being done to try to figure out what's happening with these things. The most popular book at Qumran appears to have been the Book of Psalms. There are 36 different scrolls of Psalms that have been found in those 11 caves. 30 of the Book of Deuteronomy, a favorite of Christ too. And it's interesting because what is the most often quoted book in the New Testament? Psalms. What's the second most quoted book in the New Testament? Deuteronomy. So they were favorites of that time, and this reconfirms again the New Testament's accuracy and integrity, because the same books that were popular among those at Qumran during that same period of time were those popular according to the New Testament. The book of Isaiah, 21 different scrolls. Genesis, 19. Esther, totally absent, which is a real shock, because in the Middle Ages, the greatest number of Hebrew manuscripts to be copied and made was the book of Esther. It was the most popular book among the Jews. And none so far found there at Qumran. But, you know, there's much yet to be learned. We may yet find it there. The book of Nehemiah is absent per se, but the books of Ezra and Nehemiah by the Jews were always considered as one. And there are fragments from part of Ezra, which would seem to indicate that probably Nehemiah was also there, even though fragments have yet not been identified or discovered for it. So other than those two books, all the other books of the Old Testament are found at Qumran. If you look at the Pentateuch, the five books of Moses alone, 19 scrolls of Genesis, 17 of Exodus, 13 of Leviticus, 7 of Numbers, and 30 of Deuteronomy, 12 of the manuscripts out of the 210-plus are written in what we call Paleo-Hebrew script, and those 12 manuscripts are only six different books, the five books of the Pentateuch and the book of Job. Why? Well, these are the older books of the Old Testament. That could be one reason why. Also, the Jews thought that Moses wrote the book of Job, and anything that was by Moses was to be preserved in the original Hebrew script. When we talk about that, we talk about Paleo-Hebrew script, we talk about the Jewish script. When you go to San Diego and you look at the scrolls, watch for these. Paleo-Hebrew script is the old Phoenician script. And you see here the name Yahweh. We're used to pronouncing it Jehovah at times, but it's really Yahweh. It's a Yod, Hey, Wow, Hey, reading from right to left. And in the square script that is used now in our Hebrew Bibles, which was borrowed from Babylonia. This script here on the bottom was not used by the Jews until their return from the Babylonian captivity. So what we look at as Hebrew today, what we learn as Hebrew now, is written in Aramaic script, a borrowed script. And for politically correct purposes, it is now called the Jewish script as we look at it. And here's the equivalent in transliteration for those who want to know the English. And I gave you a sidebar in the handout that includes that as well, so you can take it home and utilize that. As you're looking at some of these texts now, we go to Cave 1 and we look at a commentary on the book of Habakkuk. And as you see the way that the scrolls are annotated, I gave you some information in the handout as well, but the number up here stands for the number of the cave. The letter right after it, or an abbreviation, tells you which site of the nine that it was found at. So Q is for Qumran. H-E-V is for Nahal Hever, and M-U-R is for Wadi Murabaat, and M-A-S is for Masada, etc. And so this is Cave 1 at Qumran, the book of Habakkuk, and the little p here is the Hebrew word Pesher, which occurs in the manuscript repeatedly. It's found right there. Pesher means interpretation. It means interpretation. And so it is used as the commentary. So it's a Pesher of Habakkuk, means the commentary, an interpretation of Habakkuk. And right above that Pesher is the biblical text itself. And it's almost identical to what we have today. And then below it is the Pesher. Every interpretation is introduced with that word Pesher to tell you now this is the interpretation. And it says the interpretation of the passage is that God will not destroy his people by the hand of the nations, but in the hand of his chosen ones, God will give the judgment of all the nations. And this commentary is on the first two chapters of the book of Habakkuk. And you can see it's only partial. The bottom part has been destroyed, and the end pieces are destroyed as well. What you will see when you go to San Diego is this facsimile of the great scroll of Isaiah, the very first scroll found in the first cave. And so it is known as 1Q Isaiah A. The little superscript A is the order in which it was found. So if it's B, it's the second one that's found. If it's C, that's the third one that was found in order within that same cave. And this begins, you're looking at the very end of the book, because in Hebrew everything goes from right to left. And so the left part of it here is the final column, the 54th column that concludes Isaiah 66. It's the longest of the Dead Sea Scrolls. And as you walk down that in the exhibit, look at it. It is amazing to think that this has been preserved for us, that we might compare it with what we have today in our own Bibles. It includes the full text of the book of Isaiah. Now, we have to also keep in mind a few other things about this text. As we look at it, here we look at column 44, where we have Isaiah 52 through 54. And by the way, the little red writing up there isn't what someone wrote on the manuscripts themselves. That's what someone wrote on the photograph, the black and white photograph. This is called the St. Mark's Monastery Isaiah Scroll because it was originally kept at St. Mark's Monastery. It's now kept in the Shrine of the Book in Jerusalem. And as we look at it, we pick out one of these words, and this word is the Hebrew word that means much or many, me'od. And the way that it is spelled here, you have the mem, a wow, an aleph, a daleth, a hey, but up here we have, in the Hebrew text as we now have it, only a mem, an aleph, and a daleth. It's the same word. We pronounce it me'od, there they pronounce it me'odah. But the same manuscript for the same identical word that never changes meaning is spelled six different ways in the manuscript. Those six up here. And so it's amazing as you watch that to see how that varies within the text itself. Another thing is you look at this word and it's aleka, it's that word here that says upon you or concerning you or for you. And in the Hebrew text that time, notice that in this text, there are no vowels. You see the vowel pointings up here? Those were added by the Masoretes starting about 500 years after Christ. It became more and more set by about 800 AD, and then it was finalized around 11 or 1200 AD. And those are in order to preserve the pronunciation so that those who don't even know Hebrew can still pronounce it correctly if they learn a few basic rules, the phonetics of the language. Because by that time, the Jews were very concerned. Their young people were losing the language. Hebrew was becoming a dead language. They came back from Babylon speaking Aramaic. You see that with Christ himself. How does he speak to the little Jewish girl to rise her from the dead? He says to her, Talitha kumi. He speaks to her in Aramaic. What does Jesus say when he's hanging on the cross? Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani. He says, my God, why have you forsaken me? And he says it in Aramaic, not Hebrew. The heart language of the people had become Aramaic, not Hebrew. So 500 years after Christ, the Hebrew that was already known was beginning to deteriorate and people were beginning to forget it. And the Jews were concerned that if they didn't do something to preserve the text, it would be lost. And eventually no one would be able to read the Old Testament. So they spent nearly 600 years devising a system and then defending it, that it was absolutely accurate and compatible in every possible way with the way the text had been passed on to them. And they succeeded admirably. And then, over the last 200 or 300 years, people have begun to doubt it and question it and say these Masoretes may not have done a great job. After all, we have a Greek translation of the Septuagint done by Jews in Alexandria, Egypt, 300 years before Christ. Why not take it as our Bible? The early church used the Septuagint as its Bible. 80% of all the New Testament quotations of the Old Testament are taken from the Greek translation that was done in Alexandria, Egypt. Why don't we just go back to it? It has many differences from the Hebrew, but maybe it's more accurate. In fact, when I was in seminary over 40 years ago, and it was shortly after those finds began to be published from the Dead Sea, we were told that the Septuagint translation was proven by the Dead Sea Scrolls to be the most accurate representation of the ancient Hebrew text. How wrong they were, because the information was not all in or assimilated. But just to go back to this for a minute, that has a hey added to the end of it here, just like that. Instead of having this little comma, that little small t, is the vowel ah. And if you take that vowel out, it becomes upon you feminine singular. If you have the ah in, it's masculine singular. So how did they write or distinguish the difference before they had vowel pointings? They used vowel letters. That hey represents the ah sound, so when it's there, you know it's to someone who is masculine. Masculine singular instead of feminine singular. So there were ways to show the right pronunciation even without the vowel pointings, and these were used at Qumran some 200, 300 years before Christ. We go further to column 33, going backwards through the scroll. We started at 54, remember, in that view, and we're going back through it. We're walking through it backwards because of the way that's laid out. And you might find yourself walking through it backwards, too. We did at the Shrine of the Book, where we entered in, we were at the end of the scroll. And so we just walked through it backwards. You might do the same thing when you're going through it, or you might want to start at the beginning and come down. But watch for column 33, all right? Jot that down. You have it there. I don't know if I put 33 for you there. If I didn't put 33 for you there, you write it in. It's column 33. You will go down through. The columns are all marked and numbered. And you can go down. You can find column 33. It's equivalent to page 33, so to speak, there, out of the 54. And you go to column 33, and what do you see up here on the screen? Look at there. You see someone's writing in here, coming over here, and then coming down the side. You have some more over here. What's going on? There's four dots up here. There's dots over here. What's happening here in this scroll? And what does it tell us about these scrolls? This is in Isaiah chapter 40, and you can see how it goes through here and goes on down. And if you look carefully, even to your unpracticed eye and looking at Hebrew, you can tell someone with a different hand wrote the text that's inserted as opposed to the text that's there. You can tell it's different. A different scribe put that in there. Why did he do that? Well, notice those three dots. Those three dots just above that blue line are under a word that has four letters in it. That word is down here in the lower right-hand corner, right there, Udavar, and that's the word of our God, Udavar Eloheinu, the word and the word of our God. And the T that means four because is what's written up here, in here, and then Ruach is spirit, and then you have four dots representing the tetragrammaton, the name Yahweh, the sacred name of God, indicating, and this is the way that the scribes would indicate, when to write in the name, the holy name of God. The scribe who did the original copy was not considered worthy of writing the holy name of God in, so he just left four dots where the name was to be inserted. A different scribe who was using different ink in a different location, who was specially prepared through ritual ablutions or washings, would then do nothing but sit there and insert the holy name of God. That tells you something right away. Number one, it tells you the original scribe of this text made a huge mistake, number one. And number two, the name of God was never inserted. So that leads us to the conclusion, this text, the largest text we have, the complete scroll of Isaiah, was never, ever used in worship in any synagogue. It was not accurate enough. It was not worthy of it. It was not even completed because it was not deemed accurate enough to be completed. The eye of the scribe had started there as they shall be dried up as grass and wither like a flower because the spirit of Yahweh shall breathe on it and therefore this people is dry. And his eye jumped from the one phrase here to the identical phrase here and thought he had already written all of this over here. And so he skipped down to Udavar, and that's where he was right there. And just before that goes all of this in here that he skipped because of the similar endings of the two parts. His eye skipped, he left all of that out. That's what happens to scribes. You try that sometime. Just take something and copy it out by hand, hand it to someone else and ask them to make a copy of it. And by the time you get all the way around the room, see how many have the same thing you started out with. It's a tough job. But this is part of the proof. that you cannot just automatically accept the readings at Qumran. And there's the four dots up there for the name of God to be inserted. This was never used. It was not deemed accurate enough. So if it was not deemed accurate enough by the people of the time to be used in the synagogue at Qumran, then we need to be extra cautious about whether or not we adopt readings from it that are contrary to the text as we now have it. How do we know that those weren't mistakes as well? What kind of errors or mistakes or differences are there between our text and the text that we find of Isaiah? This is the second Isaiah scroll, and I'm just going to highlight some of the key ones here. Orthography is spelling. There are 100, now this is in 66 chapters that deal with a large number of words. I believe it's over 2,000 words. You have 107 variants in spellings. Now that's mighty few. All right? I don't know how many mistakes you might find in just a few pages I gave you. 10 differences in consonants that may or may not make any difference in meaning. 24 different grammatical forms. Different words 11 times. Only 11 different words in the entire manuscript? Only 11? 5 words omitted and 6 words added. So what kind of examples do we have of a difference? Here's an example of a word taken out, omitted. Our text, the Masoretic text, has holy, holy, holy is the Lord God of hosts in Isaiah 6:3. The Qumran text says holy, holy is the Lord God of hosts. Left out one holy. Isaiah 12:4, you plural will say in our current text, but in the Masoretic text, you singular. There's a difference of one letter being changed to make the difference there. Isaiah 37:25, waters. I drank from waters, many waters. And the Qumran text says strange waters, which is directly accommodating that, copying it to the same account in 2 Kings chapter 19, verse 24, where it does say strange waters. Isaiah 53:11, here the prophecy of the servant of the Lord, the suffering servant of the Lord. He shall see is all that is said in the text we have. But the Qumran says he shall see light. A word added to explain. And that's part of what the characteristic of this scroll is. It seems to make things clear that in the original text are not super clear. So whoever went through and did this scroll not only had those mistakes, but he was not offering an exact copy of the text. He was offering an updated interpretive version in more popular language for the people. And a scholar by the name of Rosenblum pointed this out in the 1960s and said this is something else we have to watch out for. Is many of the Qumran texts are not intended to be an exact copy of the original. They are interpretive. They're kind of like a simpler Bible translation in Hebrew to help the reader to better understand some of the more difficult expressions. And it helps to account for some of the differences in the readings. This is from K4. A Paleo-Hebrew, the old Hebrew script for the book of Leviticus. And there's just a few fragments. There's the name Israel from 734 of Leviticus. His sons in 735. The relative pronoun which in 736. And then this other fragment over here has a combination of letters, including the word all down here. That's all there. And a number of other words in here that when you do a search and you look, that fragment has nothing to do with the book of Leviticus at all, but it was published in this photograph as being these fragments from the book of Leviticus. That tells us another problem. We can't even trust all the photographs that have been published of the Dead Sea Scrolls because sometimes there was misidentification or mislabeling of the pictures being inaccurate. This one I found in a published book. When I checked on it, I found out that now the editors have discovered the error, and now that second fragment is no longer considered part of Leviticus. They're still trying to identify where it's from, but they now know it's not from Leviticus. You have to always watch out. That's why I like to read the photographs to find out what's there. First Psalm scroll found in Qumran Cave 11. A wonderful scroll, Psalms 93 to 150, so it's not all 150 psalms, plus 8 non-canonical psalms, like Psalm 154, that is only found in the Syriac Peshitta Old Testament. Notice no poetic format. It's written as though it were prose text. And it's a different order. Column 15 is Psalm 135, 17 to 21, and Psalm 136, 1 through 16. Now, notice the bottom of the scroll is damaged. Is it set in the jar? The moisture, the deterioration happens on the bottom. So a number of lines have disappeared. So in the next column, it starts 10 verses later at 136, 26. But then it jumps to Psalm 118, verse 1. Then jumps to verses 15 to 16, back to verses 8 and 9, and then forward to verse 29, and then to Psalm 145. The next column continues Psalm 145 with the gap because of the destruction at the bottom of the scroll. And the last column here, 18, has Psalm 154. This is not a canonical text of Psalms. It is a lectionary. It's a collection of readings from the Psalms to be used in worship or by a student or someone who is studying a certain topic in the book of Psalms, or someone is preparing psalms to be sung and chanted for worship in the synagogue. It was not the book of Psalms. It was excerpts from the Psalms being put together for a time of worship or study. And you can also see the Tetragrammaton, the four-letter name of God written in Paleo-Hebrew script. This often happens in the manuscripts. In spite of the rest of the manuscript being in the Jewish script, the name of God put in the Paleo-Hebrew because it's so important to maintain it as it was originally given. When we look at the textual status of these 210-plus manuscripts, we talk about 20% being written in Qumran practice. That means they use that alternate spelling, the popularized translation, and updating of the text being utilized. Sometimes many mistakes as well. The proto-Masoretic texts used to be set by the world's experts at 60%. Now it's down to 35% at latest count and is not likely to change. Emmanuel Tove is the world's leading expert on the scrolls and textual criticism, and these are his figures. Pre-Samaritan text, the Samaritan Pentateuch that began its tradition 400 B.C., completed by 100 B.C. of the five books of Moses, seemed to represent 5% of those 210-plus texts. But notice this. Those that have an affinity to the Greek translation from 300 years before Christ, the Septuagint from Alexandria, Egypt, only involve 5% of those texts. I was told as a seminary student that the majority supported the Septuagint text. You start putting this together and you find out it isn't so. The non-aligned texts that are sometimes, they could be either way. Most of them, though, seem to agree with the Masoretic text. When you put all that together, if you see it, I'm visual. I don't know about you. Numbers don't mean anything to me unless I can see it visualized. And so when you see it this way, it makes sense. There's the Masoretic text support in red compared to the Septuagint support in dark blue. It's obvious that the Qumran scrolls, after 60 years of research and study and publication and analysis, supports the Hebrew text we now have, not the Greek translation. Let's take a quick look at Qumran. You can see the Dead Sea and the hills of Moab in the background there. You're looking to the east from the Judean hills, from the upper end of the Wadi Qumran. You can see the location of cave number 4. You'd actually have to go around the end of this to see cave 4. And you can actually go up here and stand in here on this little rise here, this ridge. You can walk from the ruins out to here and look across to cave 4 and cave 5. Cave 4 actually originally had two rooms in it. But the Bedouin found it first, and they removed a lot of the scrolls. And in the process, then we have no idea from which of the rooms the scrolls came from or how they might have been arranged in case it was some sort of library. And then you look at an aerial shot down on the ruins there where I was talking about walking out. You walk out here to this little covered area, gives you shade as you look across the arm of the wadi here to cave number 4. And here's the area that was used to be. This is still thought by many to be the place of a scriptorium where the Qumran scribes would work. And it was a two-story type building. And as we look at it, we can see it here with the tables here where they would be working on the scrolls, and with storage areas back in here and down below, and a living area below that. There's many different ways of interpreting this now. because some have suggested that the tables and benches are made of plaster and a type of thin nature that doesn't make it possible to think of people sitting on them or even standing and working and writing on them. So there's a huge debate going on. Is this a dining room area? But they found a kitchen and dining room in another part of the excavation. It was very clear that that was what was involved. Is this a place where they were tanning of hides and they laid the tanned hides over the top of these tables? Is the place where pottery was made? There's all kinds of theories going on. But the original excavators, Lancaster and DeVoe, in their reports indicate that this is a scriptorium. And the majority of scholars still believe that. I mean, after all, they're finding ink wells there. They're finding pens, styluses there in that location. But oddly enough, not a single manuscript was found within the ruins of Qumran itself. All the manuscripts were found in the caves. And there's clear indication that some of those caves were used for people to live in. Nice and cool in those hot desert nights to stay in a cave. And it could be also that the caves were where they buried scrolls that were not worthy of use in the synagogue. That practice carried on by Jews even to this day. They do not destroy a scroll used in the synagogue just because it's deteriorated. Maybe moths got in, or insects have eaten it, or a fire has damaged it, or moisture has damaged it, or it's just plain worn out and is no longer usable. You don't burn them. You don't throw them in the trash. You give them an honorable disposal, an honorable burial. They put them in what is known as a geniza, a treasure room, a room where they kept wood to keep it dry in Cairo, Egypt, where thousands of fragments of scrolls were deposited after they were unusable in the synagogue in Cairo, Egypt, providing us with the second oldest group of Hebrew manuscripts. When I worked at Eisenbrons and we produced the Biblical Archaeologist issue that had to do with the Aleppo Codex, the Hebrew text, Moshe Goldstein wrote a letter and said, instruct your readers that this is the biblical text and it ought to be treated with respect. This ought not to be discarded in the trash. It ought to be treated with respect, should not be tossed on the floor. Ask them to treat this issue as though it's scripture itself. That's the view. And so why would they be put in jars? Jars that are sealed. And they're inside, those scrolls were wrapped in linen like you'd wrap a body that's being buried. Then there were jar burials also of bodies that had been found in ancient Palestine. So that was a method of burial, although you wouldn't find them in a 2-foot-high urn like these. So perhaps these were nothing more than the place where they put the scrolls that were not worthy of usage, that the scribes had messed up on, or that could not be used. And if these are discarded, unworthy scrolls, then again, what does that tell us about our using them? On the other hand, even though they might be that, they're still of value because they show us the attempt to accurately represent the text that they had at that time. And you go walk through the scroll of Isaiah, you won't find every column defiled the way that one was at column 33. There's much of it that is identical to the text we have, which helps to confirm. And where there are differences, we have to take that with a grain of salt. But it overwhelmingly supports the fact that here we have a text 1,000 years older almost than any other previous text of Isaiah we had until 1947. It is awesome. The question comes about the New Testament's relationship, because Cave 7 with its Greek fragments, 19 Greek fragments, has caused a huge furor. Jose O'Callaghan claims that there are examples here. For example, 7Q4 up there, he believes is part of 2 Timothy 3:16 through chapter 4, verse 3. Notice there that there's only three letters on it. All right? And the other part of it down here has a few more on it, so it helps a little bit there to see a little bit more. They're all from the same cave, but some of these are proven to be from the Book of Enoch in Greek, and some of them are Greek translations of Exodus and Deuteronomy. But there's one fragment that's still being debated, claiming to be from Mark chapter 6, verses 52 and 53. Is it from there or not? It's too fragmentary to tell. There's too little to know. The book of Mark could have been written as early as 65 A.D., Qumran destroyed in 68 A.D., so if this was from Mark, it would be very, very early and very, very quick after its writing, its being compiled. At nearby Nachal Hever, notice the H-E-V up there at cave number 8. The 12 in Roman numerals stands for the 12 minor prophets. The GR stands for Greek. It's the Greek Septuagint translation. Right here we have Zechariah 9:2 as Hamath also, which borders on it, Tyre and Sidon, though they are very wise. And also notice the Tetragrammaton in Paleo-Hebrew script, even in the Greek manuscript for the name of God. Masada, a few manuscripts found even there. At Herod's palace on the north end of Masada, there the view you're looking at over Masada, you're looking north toward Qumran with the Dead Sea there on your right. You can just see it creeping in the picture. The manuscripts there seem to be pure, seem to be more consistent with our Masoretic text of today, and perhaps tell us that the best Hebrew manuscripts were kept in a place of protection and greater security than a place like Qumran. And perhaps the best texts at Qumran, when the Romans advanced to destroy it in 68 AD, were sent to Masada for safekeeping because it stood until 73 AD before the Romans captured it. Where'd the scrolls go to from the temple in Jerusalem? We don't know, but some suggest they went to Yemen. And even today, Yemen Jewish Hebrew is the considered to be the purest pronunciation of classical biblical Hebrew on the planet. And there are some rabbis, I talked to a rabbi at the Wailing Wall in 98, who told me that he was convinced that the scrolls from Jerusalem, when the Romans attacked Jerusalem and destroyed the temple, were sent to Arabia and made their way to Yemen. And recently one of my students who's attending Hebrew University checked with one of his professors there and got the same story from him. In fact, he got me additional support for that argument. As a result, if you want to look at some books as we close up now and talk about preparing yourself for visiting San Diego and seeing those scrolls, this book that's edited by Philip Davies, George Brook, and Philip Calloway, The Complete World of the Dead Sea Scrolls, is probably the best book to get. Look at the footnotes I gave you in the handout, and you'll find references to all of these. This is really well done. It's concise, it's quick and easy to read, it's beautifully illustrated with colored photographs all the way through. If you're more interested in looking at the technical details of the actual publication, Discoveries in the Judean Desert in 39 volumes is the official publication, and now a new one to replace it, edited by James Charlesworth, it's called the Princeton Dead Sea Scrolls Project, is attempting to provide new detailed commentaries and republication of all the materials. A more popular one is the Dead Sea Scrolls Rediscovered. You'll see that advertised on the internet. And then if you want to read more about the archaeology of Qumran, I recommend Jody Magnus's book. And also this book, James C. Vanderkam's, in your footnotes there. I believe it's footnote number 6, it's listed. The Dead Sea Scrolls today is a beautiful, up-to-date compendium. Received Book of the Year Award by Biblical Archaeology Society in 1995. Wonderful representation of it. So I trust that as you're looking to go see these things, you'll keep in mind that this is historic. This is significant. This is another milestone that we can follow going backwards through time. And if I had time now, I'd walk you back through all the different pieces of evidence that would take us from the Masoretes around 700, 800 AD and walk us all the way back to the time of Ezra, 400 BC, with a consistent set of milestones and markers of the biblical text of the Hebrew Bible that show that the Hebrew Bible we have today is exactly the same Hebrew Bible that Ezra, as the final composer of the canon putting it together in the final collection, had. We can depend on it. It is authentic. It has integrity. It has accuracy. It is the Word of God, and He has sovereignly seen that it has been preserved, that we might understand that, and that that might help to increase our faith and our confidence in sharing the gospel of Jesus Christ with those around us. Let's bow in prayer, shall we? Father, we thank You and praise You for all that You've given us in allowing these scrolls to exist, to survive all the ravages of time, different things have occurred, that we might understand even more clearly that Your Word will not pass away. Heaven and earth may pass away, but Your Word will last. We know that especially because preserved in your mind in heaven, according to Psalm 119, verse 89. And you have instructed your people here on earth to preserve it to the best of our ability. And you have pronounced dire curses and punishment upon those who would tamper with it, who would alter it or change it, repeating it six different times throughout the Old and New Testaments. We pray that we might adhere to your word. Help us to be not just keepers of your word, preservers of your word, but doers of your word, that we might not be found to be hypocrites. We pray in Jesus' precious name. Amen.